Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is side two of For the Record program number 437, Counterculture Fascism, being recorded on December 8th, 2003. Before we get into the second side and the material contained therein, remember that sister station WFMU-FM, the heroic WFMU, is archiving the For the Record programs on Real Audio. More recent programs are streaming at WFMU.org/Dave Emery. Older programs available for download only on Real Audio at a longer URL linked to both that address and to the For the Record section of the Spitfire website at spitfirelist.com. In the For the Record section of the spitfirelist.com website, there will be a detailed annotated description of For the Record 437 within a week or so of the airing of the program. We're going to get right back into the article that comprises the vast bulk of this broadcast. This is an article called How Black is Black Metal, authored by Kevin Coogan, the author of Dreamer of the Day about Francis Parker Yockey, as well as three important articles about Altaqua that I've accessed in past programs. This article, How Black is Black Metal, was originally published in Hit List magazine's issue of February and March of 1999, and the focal point is the book The Lords of Chaos, authored by counterculture music fascist Michael Moynihan and published by Feral House. Turning to Throbbing Gristle and Genesis P. Orridge, its prime mover, one of the first bands that began using fascist imagery as a shock, sort of épater les bourgeois device. In Coogan's article, Kevin writes, GPO, that's Genesis P. Orridge. Genesis P. Orridge's interest in Hitler was not unique. British punks often incorporated swastika imagery, and Malcolm McLaren's sex boutique sold Nazi symbols side by side with S&M and fetish gear. More than just a cheap shock, the swastika deliberately mocked the ideals of the 1960s, the era of long hair, free love, and flower power. Nor could English swastika wearers be completely oblivious to the fact that the racial populist national front was then polling at an all-time high. The National Front took 18.5% of the vote in the Leicester by-election in the summer of 1976, and it appeared likely that it would win its first seat in the House of Commons from the Hackney section of East London. To the aesthetically rigid National Front and its John Bull allies in the neo-skinhead soccer hooligan scene, however, punk was too mockingly anti-patriotic and nihilist, just one more symptom of England's sad decline. Throbbing Gristle, the linchpin of the post-punk industrial turn, dressed in camouflage gear decorated with an SS-looking lightning bolt patch, and issued songs like Zyklon B Zombie and Salon Kitty, named after an SS-run brothel in Berlin. The cover for the Throbbing Gristle song Discipline on Fetish Records showed the group outside the former Nazi Ministry of Propaganda building in Berlin. Throbbing Gristle called their Hackney-based recording studio the Death Factory, and its Industrial Records logo was an unidentified picture of Auschwitz. Many punks despised Throbbing Gristle as misogynist death art fascists. At a July 6, 1978 concert at the London Film Co-op, where Boyd Rice also appeared, a fight even broke out between Throbbing Gristle and members of the Rock Against Racism-allied bands the Slits and the Raincoats. Throbbing Gristle's fascination with violent totalitarian imagery, however, had its root not in politics, but in industrial culture. At a time when disco celebrated the body, sensuality, and mindless pleasure, industrial culture had an almost Gnostic contempt for the flesh. Believing that rock music had turned into yet another pop culture narcotic, Throbbing Gristle's sound was deliberately abrasive. The Beatles proclaimed, "All you need is love." Throbbing Gristle mockingly defined its sonic assault mission as entertainment through pain, unquote, skipping down. The industrialist fascination with taboo breakers extended to charismatic leaders like Hitler and Charles Manson, who became iconic figures in a world where evil was more real than good and hate more strong than love. Yet because they, like the Marquis de Sade before them, were also fearless disruptors of middle-class morality, a Hitler or Manson were also, in a sense, perverse role models. The sheer bleakness of industrial culture also provided fertile ground for future misanthropy. If evil was more powerful than good, evil was also more natural. In a truly Hobbesian world, the social Darwinists and the Malthusians were right when they argued that only the strong could and should survive. The sense of despair felt by industrial culture was not unique. A similar heroic-slash-pessimistic worldview appeared in Europe after World War I. In the early 1920s, there arose what I shall call countercultural fascism, unquote. More a sensibility than a movement, it fused Friedrich Nietzsche's idea of the individual will to power and his contempt for middle-class morality with Oswald Spengler's belief in the imminent downfall of the West. Artists like futurist founder Filippo Marinetti, Ezra Pound, Gabriella D'Annunzio, and Ernst Jünger viewed traditional forms of conservatism with the same contempt that they felt for social democracy, rationalism, and the Enlightenment. While GPO was not really a countercultural fascist, Throbbing Gristle stood on the cusp of a revival of a countercultural fascist turn in the segments of Haute Bohemia. Another set of ideas associated with the Abraxas network had earlier been promoted by a radical Italian fascist named Franco Freda. Freda, who advocated a combined right and left-wing terrorist assault on the middle-class establishment, first outlined his ideas at a 1969 meeting of the far-right European Revolutionary Front in Regensburg, Bavaria. In his talk, which was later published as La Disintegrazione del Sistema, The Disintegration of the System, Freda argued that the nervous system of the bourgeois world, unquote, had to be disrupted with utmost violence by far-right political soldiers, unquote, working in an alliance with the far left. Freda derived essential parts of his strategy from the Italian conservative revolutionary theorist Julius Evola, the Herbert Marcuse of the post-war European far-right. Evola argued in books like Cavalcare la Tigre, Riding the Tiger, that the total collapse of modern mass society was something to be welcomed, not resisted. Radical Evolans like Freda believed that violent shocks to the system could only hasten the inevitable collapse of the hated modern order. Genesis P. Orridge chose art and music, not pistols and plastic explosives, as his aesthetic terrorist weapons. He declared that he and his supporters were waging war on mass culture. That's our job. The bottom line is to always keep destroying the status quo, unquote. In his continual quest for cultural electroshock, he had no qualms about making inflammatory statements. In his article, Gift Gas, for example, he wrote, "When you kill someone, you affirm your own existence. You heighten your perceptions. Killing puts your social intentions into perspective. If you can kill someone with the correct attitude, you can do anything. You realize the hidden fear of retribution which has informed every action." Such ideas were later to be reprised by the countercultural fascist milieu within which Michael Moynihan operated. Throbbing Gristle split up in the summer of 1981. CPO and Sleazy then formed the music group Psychic TV along with the Temple of Psychic Youth, or TOPY. Genesis P. Orridge's idea for TOPY came from one of his heroes, Aleister Crowley. Crowley, a British sex magician dubbed the most evil man in the world by the tabloid press, led a purported magical order called the Ordo Templis Orientis, or OTO. He used drugs, ritual magic, sadomasochistic sex, homosexuality, and anything else he could think of in order to magically transform his and his followers' mundane consciousness. GPO saw TOPY as an aesthetic, magical, paramilitary political order, a new, improved OTO. TOPY also fetishized Charles Manson, Jim Jones, the Process Church, and Adolf Hitler, whom GPO viewed as a powerful magician, not unlike himself, then quoting Genesis P. Orridge, "I mean, at least somebody like Hitler had vision and did some pretty exciting things. You can maximize the chance of things happening if you have a vision. And I think that's what happens when people like Hitler, they apply the forces of magic without understanding all of them. But that's how someone like Hitler could get so much done in 10 years. He kind of went from cavalry to space travel in 10 years. So he was applying the laws of magic completely, but he was misapplying them because he wasn't genuinely concerned with everybody else. And that's where the big break comes. Basically, he was probably very much like we are, but he chose the political arena. And when you choose the political arena, very weird things happen because it's on such a scale that you can't control it. That's why I'm interested in the individual and not the mass. And precisely why I've been interested in the individual is anti-fascist. And it's always accused of being fascist, and I always think that the mass is what is fascist. Mass movements and mass systems of thought. TOPY was also meant to act as a seed crystal for a rejuvenated youth culture. Genesis P. Orridge, however, always remained an aesthetic terrorist. Moynihan was in a way right when he lambasted Genesis P. Orridge as some hippie flower child in reality, unquote, because for all his excess, GPO saw his project as anti-fascist. Boyd Rice, however, clearly took a page from GPO's idea of an aesthetic political order when he formed Abraxas with Moynihan and later Adam Parfrey. Imaginary evil is romantic and varied. Real evil is gloomy, monotonous, barren, and boring. Imaginary good is boring. Real good is always new, marvelous, and intoxicating. Simone Weil. And Kevin goes on to write, industrial culture in the United States never attained the brooding complexity of its British cousin. In America, it remains jumbled up with a salmagundi of styles that include John Waters' consciously anti-political trash aesthetics, slasher movie Grand Guignol, and the deconstruction of highbrow academia by Parisian postmodernism. The French invasion was closely tied to the cultural left through intellectual icons like Michel Foucault. Unlike the bleak British industrialists, transgressive leftist art workers like Karen Finley wanted to épater les bourgeois and promote good causes like feminism and gay liberation. Since all good transgressives used drugs like porn and despised Middle America, Norman Rockwell, Jesse Helms, and Pat Robertson, a natural alliance existed between the West Side liberals at the Museum of Modern Art and the downtown avant-garde at La Mama. By the way, he's talking about New York City here. Continuing. A small group of mostly straight white male scenesters, however, used transgressive tactics to attack what they saw as the therapeutic left's hegemony over Bohemia. Unapologetic bad boys in search of an aesthetic that couldn't be co-opted, they turned to cult leaders like Manson and Jim Jones, serial killers like John Wayne Gacy, violent images of deformed or dismembered bodies, weird conspiracy theories from the far left and far right, UFO abduction tracts, and hate rants by black nationalists and Klansmen. Some wanted to épater les communistes because they believed that artists should not live in a world of self-imposed censorship for fear of violating every leftist and feminist dogma du jour. There was also the fear that Bohemia, long a bad boy Shangri-La for sex, drugs, and rock and roll, was turning into a therapeutic, no-smoking zone. And what better in-your-face way to say F you to the sissies, parlor pinks, and the feminazis than to play the ace card of transgressional aesthetic fascism? The new hip regime of mean was exemplified by the infamous Los Angeles Amok catalog. Amok Press's bestseller, Apocalypse Culture, a collection of rants, raves, conspiracy theories, and aesthetic terrorist tracts, was another key text. Adam Parfrey, owner of Amok and later Feral House, first entered the scene in 1980 with IDEA, IDEA, a Southern California-based research-type journal about punk culture. He then moved to New York, where he met the art designer George Petros. Parfrey also became friends with Joe Coatman, a painter and performance artist once famous for biting the heads off live mice and blowing himself up on stage. In 1984, Parfrey and Petros created Exit, a New York-based journal heavy on graphic design. Exit also drew on contributions from cinema of transgression filmmakers Richard Kern, Nick Zedd, and actress and musician Lydia Lunch, as well as from artists and musicians like Joe Kuehlman, Jim Thirlwell, Thor Fetus, Genesis P. Orridge, and Boyd Rice. Exit even included drawings by convicted murderers Mark David Chapman, John Wayne Gacy, Charles Manson, and the Night Stalker Richard Ramirez. It used strong, psychedelic-like designs, cartoons, totalitarian agitprop images, photos of Hitler, and John Hartfield-style collages to punch outraged readers in the eye. Parfrey worked with Petros on the first three issues of Exit before leaving to create Amok Press. Once a success to Scandal, Exit's increasing fascination with fascism doomed it to just six issues. Issue 5, for example, featured a particularly rancid piece of anti-Semitism entitled The Execution of Carl Jung, which was conceived by George Petros with text researched by Robert N. Taylor, a former paramilitary Minuteman turned racial Odinist. The final 1994 Exit included contributions from Michael Moynihan and James Mason, an American Nazi whose book Siege was published by Moynihan. While producing Exit, Petros also served as an editor at Seconds, an eclectic New York-based music magazine that Moynihan, Rice, and Parfrey regularly write for. The new glorification of the instinctual and the barbaric, the belief in the survival of the fittest, and the hatred of both Christian morality and liberal humanism were all music to the ears of Anton LaVey, the founder and head of the San Francisco-based Church of Satan. Not surprisingly, Boyd Rice developed close ties with LaVey in the early 1980s. In 1984, Rice set up the Abraxas Foundation as a social Darwinist think tank, unquote. An Abraxas tract called Wake proclaimed long live death, unquote, and hailed Malthusianism as nature's eternal fascism, unquote. The Church of Satan also maintained close ties to Temple of Psychic Youth. Today, Rice himself is a member of the Church's governing inner council, the Count Circle, the Council of Nine. He also conducted the last interview with LaVey for Seconds prior to LaVey's death on October 29th, 1997. I would add that both Michael Moynihan and Boyd Rice are officials with the Church of Satan. Continuing, LaVey, who was often seen only as just a libertarian maverick, called for a new kind of fascism in a 1994 interview with Michael Moynihan in Seconds. Moynihan's essay, The Faustian Spirit of Fascism, was also published in the Church of Satan's magazine, The Black Flame. LaVey even contributed an introduction to a new edition of Ragnar Redbeard's Might is Right, a Nietzschean and social Darwinist tract first published in 1896, which LaVey had liberally plagiarized in his own book, The Satanic Bible. The editor of the new edition of Might is Right is listed as Katya Lane. Katya Lane is the wife of David Lane, an Odinist leader of the high-profile far-right paramilitary group called The Order, who is now serving a life sentence for conspiring to murder a Denver radio personality named Alan Berg. The author of Might's afterword is arguably even more devilish than LaVey. He is none other than George Hawthorne, head of the white racist musical group Rahoa, or Racial Holy War, and founder of Resistance Records, whom Michael Moynihan interviewed for Seconds and The Black Flame. Moynihan is also thanked in the new edition of Might is Right for helping make the book possible. By the way, Resistance Records is now run by the National Alliance, who published Serpent's Walk and the Turner Diaries. Previously, it was being financed by Liberty Lobby, and the fellow who was helping to finance Resistance Records when it was being financed by the fascist Liberty Lobby was a guy named Todd Blodgett, who was a former Reagan White House staffer. That, by the way, is discussed in FTR 211. Continuing. Moynihan is also thanked in the new edition of Might is Right for helping make the book possible. In the mid-1980s, Adam Parfrey formed Amok Press, the precursor to Feral House, with Ken Sweezy of the Amok catalog. Parfrey's Amok's first book, Michael, was an English translation of Nazi propagandist minister Joseph Goebbels' soul novel. Parfrey's next book, Apocalypse Culture, was followed in 1988 by The Manson File, which was edited by Nicholas Schreck, the boyfriend of LaVey's daughter, Zena, in collaboration with Boyd Rice and others. Rice regularly visited Manson and even campaigned to get him released from jail through an Abraxas spinoff called the Friends of Justice. Via Manson, the Abraxas Circle came into contact with James Mason, a former member of George Lincoln Rockwell's American Nazi Party and the eccentric head of the National Socialist Liberation Front. Mason had established contact with Manson in the early 1980s through an NSLF member named Perry Red Worthen. Worthen later murdered a 17-year-old high school student in Oroville, California, because the boy told police that Worthen had been distributing racist literature. In the late 1980s, Rice got into hot water due to his friendship with Robert Hike, a.k.a. Bob Blitz. Hike is the leader of a skinhead group called American Front that once attacked the San Francisco anarchist bookstore Bound Together. Although he denied having any political ties to Hike, the growing unpopularity of Abraxas in San Francisco led Rice to decamp to Denver, Colorado. By the way, on the internet is a picture of both Boyd Rice and Robert Hike in full Nazi uniform. It's actually a San Francisco Chronicle file photo. Continuing, as for Parfrey, he first moved his publishing operation from New York to Los Angeles. After the L.A. riots, he relocated to Portland and then returned south to Venice, California. While in Portland, Parfrey, whose own mother is Jewish, hired the late Keith Steinle, an openly gay former editor of the Journal of the Institute for Historical Review, the world's leading Holocaust denial outfit, to write Feral House press releases. Steinle's name also appeared on a leaflet, along with that of Moynihan and Portland artist Diabolos Rex, as part of a Boyd Rice non-Total War performance in that city. Michael Moynihan was Boyd Rice's Denver roommate in 1991. That summer, their apartment was visited by men who first said they wanted to talk to Moynihan because, as he later recalled, they believed I had witnessed the murder of a black man, unquote. The visitors, who turned out to be Secret Service agents, next accused the stunned Moynihan of plotting with some Manson followers to assassinate then-President George Bush during a visit to Denver. One year later, Moynihan was more preoccupied by literary than legal matters. His Denver-based Storm Press published Siege, a 400-page anthology of the writings of James Mason, the Nazi fan of Charles Manson. In his acknowledgments, Moynihan, Michael M. Jenkins, thanked, among others, both Adam Parfrey and Anton LaVey for their help in facilitating Siege's publication. Mason argued in Siege that National Socialism had lost its violent revolutionary edge. Quote, "We want to see crime and chaos rise to such a degree where the system becomes no longer viable and falls apart," he wrote. In a tract called Smashing the Pig System, he growled, "If a bunch of black nationalists robs a Brinks truck, if they kill some system pigs, who cares?" Unquote. Siege also paid homage to white racist lone wolf assassins like Mason's former American Nazi Party colleague Joseph Franklin, who specialized in shooting interracial couples or race traitors, and James Huberty, who massacred a largely Hispanic clientele at a McDonald's restaurant in San Diego. Mason felt that the lone wolves were merely expressing healthy Viking berserker rage, unquote, against Big Brother, unquote. He especially liked the fact that, since they acted alone, these lone wolves were very difficult to catch. Siege also glorified Charles Manson. Mason even created a Manson-inspired successor group to the NSLF called Universal Order, in an effort to transcend the traditional left-right spectrum. In his introduction to Siege, Moynihan also highlighted Mason's call for a unity of extremes against the system. At this point in history, there were no such things as innocent bystanders. The degeneration and decline of the West had long since passed to the point where such ideas had any meaning. Now, it all boiled down to whether you were working for or against the system, and anything which helped further augment instability in society, no matter where it came from, or what opposing, i.e. left-wing or Marxist group, might be responsible. The break with conservatism and right-wingism, the categories most people invariably believe Nazism falls into, had now been made once and for all. Mason will reiterate that he wishes the best of luck to anyone willing to attack the system head on. For all its crudeness, Siege echoed Franco Frida's radical Evolian call for social disruption in La Desintegrazione del Sistema. Storm also plans to issue the first English translation of Evola's 1953 book, Men Among the Ruins. In August 1993, 1 year after Siege was published, Varg Vikernes murdered Euronymous. Although Moynihan was not a black metalist, the lure of Norway's new Charles Manson was too much to resist, skipping down. In Lords of Chaos, Moynihan suggests that Vikernes is an avatar of a long-suppressed Odinist archetype, analogous to what Jung claimed for Nazi Germany in his famous 1936 essay on Wotan. Moynihan clearly believes in racial archetypes and told Ohm Clock, "Racial achievements are distinctive between different races, and I think that culture is based on race. I don't understand why it's a taboo topic to discuss," unquote. In Lords of Chaos, Moynihan relies upon Cadman, editor of a Vienna-based journal called Aorta, to bolster the racial archetype thesis. And then skipping down, despite his use of Cadman's theories, Moynihan claims in LOC that there is absolutely no specific connection between practitioners of Nordic religion and the black metal scene. In fact, he writes, "Public assumptions that such a link exists would have been a severe liability to these groups." Moynihan, however, neglects to mention that he himself was a leading member of a U.S.-based racialist Old Norse and Germanic religion movement called the Asatru Alliance of Independent Kindreds, or AA, which is headquartered in Arizona. The AA evolved out of a 1960s Odinist Nordic revival movement called the Asatrial Free Assembly. The AA faction argued that a Norse religious movement should only include people of Northern European descent. It also publishes a journal called Vorthru, which is edited by Robert Ward, the former editor of a rightist music zine called The Fifth Path. He is also almost certainly the R. Ward thanked by Moynihan for his typesetting contribution to Siege. Another AA leader, Valgard, or Michael Murray, was a former leader of Rockwell's American Nazi Party. Moynihan's close friend, Robert Nicholas Taylor, who publishes an Odinist journal called The Continuing Clan, is yet another AA bigwig with a far-right bio. The rightist music journal Ohm Clock reports that during a, quote, a 12-year stint as a national spokesman for the Minutemen, he, Taylor, went on to become director of intelligence and set up the first guerrilla training schools ever to exist in the United States, unquote. Taylor's call for the racial balkanization of America, an argument associated with the late clanarchist leader Robert Miles, was also featured in the last issue of Exit. Moynihan now lives in Portland, where he moved in order to work for Feral House. And listeners can access this the full article, How Black is Black Metal. The internet address will be in the description in the For the Record section of SpitfireList.com. Noting again the information in that article, and I've read most of it, but there's a lot more. September 11th, 2001, the San Jose Mercury News carried the following article that I digested while I was absorbing the horrors of that day. By Michelle Guido, Sacramento killer vowed not to be taken alive. Gunman's short, horrific life included fascinations with guns, neo-Nazism, Timothy McVeigh, and Charles Manson. Wonder where he got ideas like that. That concludes Side 2 of For the Record program number 437, Counterculture Fascism, being recorded on December 8th of 2003. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.